Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
We'll move on to the conclusion of this speech at ASPO 2011 by Charles Maxwell, a renowned energy analyst.
I think what we're facing is something like a huge cube. A cube has six sides, and the first three sides would be your fossil fuels, oil, gas, and coal. Fourth would be a non-fossil fuel, but still a traditional fuel now, nuclear power. Fifth would be the sustainables, the renewables, the biotechs, and the biological fuels, the solar and geothermal and wind power and hydro. Hydro is most of that, and I think you all understand that photovoltaics and wind are so small that they will not make a very substantial contribution in the next 15 to 20 years, simply because they're starting from such a low base. Last of the six, and the most interesting, is what is not a fuel, but it can be treated for measuring purposes as a fuel, and that's energy conservation and efficiency. Conservation implies that you don't use it, and there are not a lot of instances in which you don't want to use it, but there are a lot of instances in which you want to use it, but use it much more efficiently. And we've been talking about, I think Bob Rapier said something about opportunities and being in the investment world. I'm always looking for those opportunities. This will be the great area, in my opinion, for opportunities to invest successfully. In a world absolutely of slower growth, we'll be lucky to have growth, but we'll probably have some small amount of growth. There won't be a lot of industries that are rapidly escalating their ability to earn money and pay dividends and do all those good investment things. Most industries are going to be constrained by these conditions. But the energy efficiency business is going to be huge. Now, there was a question here about how he would be heating New England's homes with heating oil and so on, and what a difficult situation it was, and it is. I've been there and I've seen it. But I am connected with a group that's working on that. And it just happens, it's an interesting example, but there has been some changes and some really a revolution in thinking about heat pumps. And a heat pump is designed to separate active molecules, that is, warm materials, from cold materials, passive molecules. It is amazing what can be done. A refrigerator is a common heat pump. And we're running about a 50% conservation factor. We're able to heat a home for about 50% less energy. And even though we still may need to use natural gas or heating oil, it is incredible to think that it could be done with 50% of the thermal power that we've got. So I think that this area of innovation, in which America is so good, is going to be our Saudi Arabia in the end. The other big factor is going to be natural gas. So we aren't going to do very much in the near term with the renewables. The oil is not really, we're not really able to show incremental growth there. Coal is going to be held back. Nuclear is not going to come in for another 20 years. It's not acceptable yet. And we're not going to do much with it until several more generations have come through, generations of nuclear equipment. So energy efficiency and natural gas are going to be the two great spurs out. Will they be enough? I think the answer is plainly no. So as I do my work, it shows that we're going to be running into energy shortages by 2015, and we're going to have something like 15 years of this tightness encompassing us. Now, that you're suddenly thinking, my God, this is another doom and gloom speech. I really think that we've got to think about this carefully, and I want to leave you with this thought, that happiness is often seen as a question of expectations. And our expectations, not this group, I must say, but the expectations of the American people as a whole, are very high, and there is going to be a period of time in which all of our societies in Europe, Canada, America, Mexico, Latin America, Africa, we're all going to go through a blunting of expectations. It's going to be a hard time because Not only are things going to be turning down and turning flat, but we're also going to be disappointed because our dreams are not being met. But to the extent to which our dreams were material, they're probably not that important and not that realizable anyway. But to the extent to which our dreams involve the natural world, it may be that something like going into more gardening for grossly economic reasons has other benefits. I think it does. You know, you're not going to be able to get fruits and vegetables from California so easily, and they're going to be very expensive because of the whole mobility of the world is going to slow down with higher costs. But does that mean that your diet will suffer? Not really. Not necessarily. There are a lot of joys we're going to be capable of enjoying that our grandparents and our great-grandparents enjoyed. I mean, it's not as if people haven't passed through this, what you might call an age of austerity before. It's happened many times. I think many of you know that, just to take a classic example of this surprising outlook that occurs in the midst of problems, the Danish state made a very careful study after the Second World War of the deteriorating health situation. This was in the 60s. And they found that the most healthy time for the Danish citizens that they ever enjoyed, the lowest rates of cancer, the lowest rates of cold, the lowest rates of pneumonia, was in the war years, 43, 44, 45. It doesn't surprise you, because when you think about it, you realize why. They didn't have the corrupting influence of liquor and tobacco and and all these things that we, the sweets and the ice cream and the butter and the eggs, the things we really love. But there was tremendous health. And all I want to say is that I think we're going into a period of austerity. We think hard about it. There are some real joys to be had there too. Thank you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We've just heard two talks from the concluding day of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas, USA, annual conference. This one was in Washington, D.C. in early November 2011. The recordings of Jeff Rubin and Charles Maxwell were made by our Radio EcoShock correspondent, Jerry Williams. Thank you, Jerry. You'll notice neither Rubin or Maxwell mentioned climate change at all, as though extreme weather damages and rising seas are not also major impacts on our economic prospects, as though the world will never limit fossil fuel production because we are wrecking the climate for all foreseeable time. Jeff Rubin, I know, does acknowledge climate change, but it is absent here. Why? We'll now go to our feature interview for this week. From Florence, Italy, it's an honor to speak with Ugo Bardi. We often wonder which comes first and which is worst, climate change or peak oil, but this may not even be the right question. To help sort this out, we are going to Italy to talk with Ugo Bardi. He is a professor of chemistry at the University of Firenze, that is Florence. Ugo is a rare bridge in two worlds. He is the founder of ASPO Italy, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. Ugo is a contributor and member of the editorial board of the Oil Drum blog and has published two books in Italian on oil depletion. But Bardi is also a member of an association of Italian climatologists. His latest book in English is The Limits to Growth Revisited, published in 2011 by Springer. Ugo Bardi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, Ugo, I've been following peak oil for years, interviewing people like Richard Heinberg and James Howard Kunstler, and of course I speak with climate scientists. But it's very seldom I find anyone to talk about both. Why is this?
Well, I'm not the only one who can speak about both issues, but you're right, it's not so easy. There is a divide, there is a frontier in between the people who deal with peak oil or are concerned about peak oil and people who are more concerned about climate change. I think I could tell you a story, and it goes back to 2003 when I went to attend my first peak oil conference in Paris, and that was all new for me, this story of peak oil, and it was new for me and for many people who came to listen to this conference to these speakers about oil, but these great geologists who had invented this idea that oil was going to, I mean, not to run out, but to become difficult to extract. So there was a reaction. I remember it very well. People said, well, what is that? It's if we have been fighting so much about climate change, then these people come up with this idea of peak oil, and then it's going to ruin everything, because if we are going to run out or anyway not have enough oil, then what's the point of worrying about climate change? So there has been, from that time, there has been a conflict in between the two sides of the problem. And that makes a little bit difficult to find people who have the same interest or competency, or anyway they have been trying to explore both issues. But let me tell you that this is changing. I think it's going to change very rapidly and very soon, because people who have been working with peak oil are discovering that climate change is a very serious problem, probably more serious than peak oil. And climatologists are beginning, a bit slowly I'd say, but to understand there is a problem of depletion. So the scenarios, the calculation about what's going to happen must take into account the fact that we are not going to burn oil all the way to the end of the 21st century. As they say, normally we do this calculation and tell us, okay, by 2100 we're going to have 6-8 degrees of increase in temperature, but we are not going to be able to burn as much oil as many people think. But the problem remains very serious, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but the two problems are a mirror of each other.
Right. Well, let's go back to March 2009. You wrote an important article in the Oil Drum blog called Fire or Ice, The Role of Peak Fossil Fuels in Climate Change Scenarios. And you did begin with an important point. Climatologists, and especially the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, were assuming that we could fill the sky infinitely with carbon, as though supplies will never run out. Do you think the IPCC is aware of the problem of peak oil?
As I said, it is changing, but slowly. They still are locked a little bit to this kind of calculation they have been doing for years. So they are not going right now to include peak oil in their calculation, as far as I understood, because the new report from IPCC is going to come out soon, and so we will see what they say in this regard. But let me repeat the point. The uncertainty is so high that we cannot exclude that even with the limited amounts of oil and other fossil fuels that peak oil scenarios imply, even that may be very dangerous in terms of climate change.
Well, back in 2009, when you reviewed the small amount of literature out there, what did you find?
Well, in 2009, there were several attempts to include peak oil scenarios in the IPCC, or let's say climate scenarios, to make a synthesis of the two ideas, see what comes out. And the results were that, well, of course, you are not going to burn so much oil. So maybe, within some assumptions, what happens is that you go up to a certain level of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, and then you go down because you stop burning. You slow down burning, better said. You slow down, and then natural processes like the oceans absorb this CO2 from the atmosphere, and so you go down. And within some calculations, you arrive to the end of the cycle, more or less unscathed. You're safe and alive, let's say. But I think that all these calculations that I reviewed in 2009 have been made obsolete by something new that's happening. And what's happening is that there is a strong reaction of the fossil fuel industry against peak oil, and that was said. Some people said that, look, what you're doing here, making calculations, you don't take into account that people will start burning dirty fuels when peak oil comes. It probably came in some form. And so what's happening now, what is worrisome and is worrying me a lot, is that in 2010 we have seen an increase in CO2 concentration, in emissions in the atmosphere, which was never seen ever in the past. So that's despite the fact that the oil production is more or less static. We are not producing so much. The economy is not going well, so we are not increasing. The economy is not growing, but CO2 emissions are growing, and very fast. Why that? Because people are running oil over cheap oil, the easy oil, the oil which is not so damaging. And so they're moving to the expensive oil, dirty oil, other sources of liquid fuels like tar sands and coal, you can liquefy or gasify coal. And that means that we are getting less energy but more CO2. And that's a big problem because that's making all the calculations wrong, which is normally what happens when you deal with the future. You make some models and you think something will happen, but as the future comes, you have to adapt all the time, change and modify. The models are still useful, but you need to follow what happens for real. So the situation right now is very worrisome.
And you also brought up a sticky point. There may be no point in spending billions or trillions to capture carbon for sequestration. You said that in your article, the oil is limited. We may not have to spend money to sequester it.
Yeah, that's possible. What we're doing now, we're spending money into obtaining liquid fuels from dirty sources, which is bad. Then if we were to leave everything, go the easy way to oil to run out the way that, let's say nature wanted it to go. I mean, we don't have so much oil. Let's adapt with oil running out. And so that's a strategy that we could have taken. Okay, we could have decided, all right, oil is so expensive, we are just going to use less and concentrate into doing different things like exploiting renewable energy or even nuclear energy. Some people like that. And that would have been a strategy. In that case, we would not have needed to sequester anything. Just slow down consumption, slow down production. And so we come out of that problem more or less safe. But what we're doing is not that. And right now, we're extracting oil from these sources, from these dirty sources. Then one possibility would be to sequester it, even though that is expensive.
Ugo, it's not just that climate science is slow to see peak oil. On the other side, it seems some peak oil specialists don't know enough about global warming. This came out last April in a panel discussion at the 9th annual ASPO conference in Brussels. There was a good panel organized by the Club of Rome. And one of the surprises for me was Ian Dunlop of ASPO Australia. He used to represent the coal industry there, and now he's talking about climate change. So we're seeing some crossovers, but there are still people in the peak oil movement who deny climate change is happening or that it's important at all.
A few, yes, still do. There is some new ideas are always difficult to accept, especially for people who spend their life working for the oil industry. They are specialized into prospecting for oil, extracting oil, optimizing oil extraction. It's very difficult for them to accept that what they're doing, they've been doing for older life is bad in absolute terms because we are damaging the planet and ourselves in the process. But I am very encouraged by what you said, like people who had been working mainly with peak oil, like me. I have been working with peak oil for a long time. And then slowly I came to discover, look, this is a problem, peak oil, of course, but it's very small in comparison to the damage that we can have from climate change. So we need to address climate change with great urgency. And it's a major problem.
And you've just mentioned another big problem, and you raised it in your 2009 article, and that's climate sensitivity. I've just heard a talk by NASA's James Hansen at the 2011 meeting of the American Geophysical Union. As before, Hansen emphasized we've grossly underestimated climate sensitivity. He thinks 350 parts per million may be the tipping point for the Arctic ice. And in the UK, Kevin Anderson is raising similar alarms, and we've just had news out a couple of days ago about Russian scientists finding fountains of methane coming out of Siberia. So I guess my point is, even if we start to run out of affordable oil, nature may take over with positive feedbacks, regardless of our oil supplies. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you mentioned an interesting point, these fountains of methane in Russia. This is very worrisome, you see, because when we say climate sensitivity, we think that it's a nice number that stays constant over time. We can argue how large or how small it is. It's fine. But Hansen, especially, has been saying, I think correctly, you said, you know, this is the future. And the future is never what you expect. So the future changes. The future always surprises you. And it would be a very bad surprise if we were to see one of these extreme scenarios. Let's call these extreme because we hope they don't occur, but you never know, because you have this methane which is blowing up from the permafrost, and if that takes over the system, then it is not important anymore how much oil we burn, what we do, what we don't do, what kind of treaties we agree on, where we do a conference, whatever we want to do. It would be an extremely difficult and dangerous situation. So sometimes people say, well, we are not sure about climate change, so we should not do anything. No, it is because we are not sure that we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And there are some scenarios, as you mentioned, like James Hansen has been proposing these scenarios. It's been said to be an extremist, which maybe is exaggerating. I don't know. But I tell you frankly, honestly, I am a bit scared about these things because we don't know really what we are doing with this planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Ugo Bardi, an Italian professor and author who follows both peak oil and climate change. Ugo, we talked about the separation of experts studying these fields. Now that we're talking about peak oil resources, why don't you tell us about your new book, The Limits to Growth Revisited?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, that too, because everything that's happening today had been seen as a possibility back in 1972 with this book, The Limits to Growth, which, as you know, has been very much criticized and even demonized. But now, after almost 40 years from the date of publication, we can see that book had really caught some very important basic facts of our situation right now, because they already had this point, the point you mentioned before, the apparent contrast for those people worrying about peak oil and those people who worry about climate change. But this dichotomy, this problem, was there already in the book in 1972, because they already said, look, there are two main factors which are going to affect the future. One is resource depletion. Depletion is going to cause us problems because we'll run out gradually, slowly, of resources, so the economy is going to suffer. But at the same time, you have the problem of pollution. At that time, they said something about CO2 and global warming, but it was not really known. But they say, okay, there is a problem of the waste to create with industrial activity, and this waste is accumulating. Now we know that it is accumulating in the form of, mainly in the form of carbon dioxide, which is probably going to cause the most damages to our civilization. But already there's a scenario where very easily tweaked from one side to another. We said, okay, we change a little bit the input and we get that the economy is affected mostly by climate change. We change a little bit the parameters and then the economy is affected mainly by depletion. So this is the problem that we have today, because, as I said, the two problems are a mirror of each other. We are waving in between the two possibilities and the two problems, that of solving the problem of depletion and the problem of climate change.
Well, it's likely we're going to suffer through both, isn't it?
Possibly, yes. So it may be that one is much worse than the other. Right now, we cannot say.
Well, you know, countless hours and miles of type have been spent arguing about which will hit hardest first. Would you care to risk your opinion on that?
Good question. The point is, we can live without oil. Our ancestors have been living without oil for millions of years. But our ancestors have never lived with so much CO2 in the atmosphere as there is now. So if climate change occurs first, it's much more dangerous than peak oil. We should worry much more about climate change than about peak oil. In my opinion, right now, if you want me to give you my opinion, I am more afraid of climate change, because I see things happening very fast and too fast for me.
Ugo Bardi, I can't help worrying that we haven't really asked the right questions yet about the relationships between fossil fuel availability and climate change. What needs a lot of research and discussion, do you think?
There is always something to be researched. We never arrive to a complete understanding of anything. Some people say the science is settled. No, there's never, science is never settled. The problem is that we cannot wait longer. We cannot wait until we have the perfect knowledge of everything. Otherwise, we will wait forever and we will do nothing.
What are you working on lately?
Oh, well, I'm working on models. I'm trying to understand what's going to happen. It's a very fascinating subject, that to studying the future. Because the future, it's something that you can study. You can never really predict it, but you can study it. You can make models, and then if you have good models, the future never really surprises you. That's the utility of models. It's not that you can know exactly what's going to happen, but you are prepared for what is going to happen, and that's what I'm working on.
Do you have a website or two you want to recommend for English listeners, and maybe also one or two for people who listen in other languages?
Yeah, my site is called Cassandra, as you may imagine from what I'm saying. It's called Cassandra's Legacy, and if you look in Google or Ugo Bardi and Cassandra, then you find me easily, and that's a point where I discuss these things in English, and I have also a site with the same name, Cassandra, in Italian, if you can read Italian. And so the job of the Cassandra sometimes is boring because you know that what you say will not be believed. So that's sort of boring that you know that you speak to people who don't listen. But it's also very interesting because you discover things that many people don't suspect. And even Cassandras have followers, people who believe them.
As we finish up, is there a final thought you want to leave with us?
Well, that's the point. And I think the crucial point of the future for humankind will be believing in Cassandra.
This is Radio EcoShock. You've been listening to Ugo Bardi. He's a professor of chemistry at the University of Florence. He researches both peak oil and climate change, and he's recently published the book The Limits to Growth Revisited. Ugo, thank you for spending time with us.
Thanks to you. It was a pleasure.
Find more links to Ugo Bardi and this discussion in our show blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. That's it. We're out of time. Find a link to download the whole hour-long ASPO 2011 presentation by Jeff Rubin and Charles Maxwell, including the Q&A, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. I have links to ASPO USA there and the 2011 conference. Download this show, the interviews, and all our past programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening, and let's meet again next week.
But, you know, for someone like me, I don't really care. If you can burn it, it's good enough for me, and probably for most folk as well.